Okay, thank you. I would like to thank the organizers for giving me a chance to present this work. And I also apologize to people who have already heard this talk. I might repeat myself. So this work is based on the series of papers which started out in Michigan in collaboration with Bobby Acharya, Gordy Kane, Piyush Kumar, Jing Shao, Diana Vaman, and Scott Watson. So I'm not going to go through the outline. I'm just going to start out because I only have 30 minutes. Why do we study four-dimensional string theory and M-theory vacua? The answer should be pretty obvious when you look at the list of properties that generically occur in four-dimensional string compactifications. If you want to construct something that resembles the standard model, you need these ingredients, such as hierarchical Yukawa couplings, non-abelian gauge symmetry, chiral fermions, et cetera, et cetera. So this is all very nice, but the question arises, can we actually make any general predictions, and even in principle? In practice, of course, we know that it's hard, but in principle, can we make predictions? So when we compactify down to four dimensions, we obtain a multitude of scalar fields, so-called moduli fields, which parameterize the internal metric, brain positions, et cetera, et cetera. The masses of these moduli have to be large enough not to, for instance, not to violate some constraints from the Big Bang nuclear synthesis and various other constraints, cosmological constraints. However, there is also a subtlety, which Piyush mentioned in his talk. For example, if you look at the gauge kinetic function, for instance, for the QCD, then the real part, which represents the inverse, this is the volume of the visible sector, some cycle which supports the visible sector, the corresponding modulus has to be heavy, and the axion part has to be very light. So that sort of gives you another subtlety in this story. We know that the masses and the couplings in string theory are functions of the moduli fields, and if we stabilize all the moduli, we could in principle compute those couplings. So in particular, there is one question which string theory should be able to address, namely explain the hierarchy between the electroweak scale and the Planck scale. So, of course, when people talk about the hierarchy problem, supersymmetry, in particular low-scale supersymmetry, comes to mind. So we know that there are some very good hints for low-scale supersymmetry from bottom up, such as radiative electroweak symmetry breaking, gauge coupling unification. Some people might consider the dark matter as another hint. The LSP as a candidate, a WIMP candidate. However, we know that while supersymmetry can actually stabilize the hierarchy, it doesn't explain the number, why there is such a huge disparity between those two scales. So back in the mid-80s, the standard law was that some strong hidden sector gauge dynamics may generate some potential for the moduli and also generate a small scale. And so then, of course, people started working on flux compactifications and realized that that idea may not work. But we think that in the context of these G2 compactifications, this idea is actually very natural, and it can be implemented from top down. And so in these papers, we implemented this idea. Now, so let us consider M-theory compactified on real seven-dimensional manifolds, which are singular, so the word manifolds has to be taken in quotes, and I will explain why they should be singular. G2 holonomy is required to have n equals 1 supersymmetry in four dimensions. So these are just relations between the Riemannian metric and the so-called associative free form. So there is a one-to-one correspondence between the free form phi and the Riemannian metric of the manifold G. So we can expand the free form in basis harmonic free forms, where Si's are the coordinates on the moduli space and phi's are the basis harmonic free forms. So here, the fluctuations of Si correspond to the fluctuations of the metric, the fluctuations of phi, sorry, correspond to the fluctuations of the metric. So the advantage of doing M-theory compactifications on G2 manifolds, the main advantage, in my opinion, is that unlike Calabi-Yau compactifications, where you have many types of different moduli, you have complex structure moduli, you have Kähler moduli, also you have the dilaton, you have vector bundle moduli, et cetera, et cetera. So here, all the moduli are on equal footing, and there's only one type of moduli. So the imaginary part corresponds to the periods of the associative free form, and the real part corresponds to the periods of the supergravity three form. Okay, so this is all you have to deal with. Also, another important point is that the axions here, which pair up with the moduli, with the geometric moduli, possess a Peccei-Quinn symmetry. And this symmetry is inherited from the gauge symmetry of the free form. And so, because all the moduli have this Peccei-Quinn symmetry, the superpotential is protected from receiving perturbative corrections. So in the absence of fluxes, so flux contributions would be at tree level, but if we turn off all the fluxes, then the entire superpotential will be non-perturbative. And so hierarchies, exponential hierarchies will be generically expected. If the entire superpotential consists of exponential terms, we don't expect that all the exponential terms will be of the same order of magnitude. So now the non-abelian gauge fields in these models arise from codimension 4 singularities. So there is a singular submanifold, free cycle, Q, which is also referred to as the associative free cycle or supersymmetric free cycle, along which there is an orbifold singularity. So for example, we can consider a local G2 manifold X, a local model where you have a non-compact G2 manifold X, where Q is a supersymmetric three cycle. And so this represents an ALE vibration over Q. So what you get as a result is a seven-dimensional SUN gauge theory, which lives in seven dimensions, which are four Minkowski and times the supersymmetric three cycle Q. Chiral fermions in M theory arise from codimension 7 singularities. This happens when the rank of the singularity gets enhanced at some point on this three cycle Q. So for instance, if you have a point where SUN gets enhanced to SUN plus 1, you have N of SUN at that point. So you have charged chiral matter. And so these are the ingredients that we need to build the standard model. And I will talk about the Yukawa couplings as well, just briefly later. So to stabilize the moduli, we're going to work in the framework of N equals 1, D equals 4 supergravity. And in order to start, we need to know the Kähler potential for the moduli. So the Kähler potential was derived by Beasley and Witten in that paper. It's just negative 3 times the log of the volume, the seven-dimensional volume, which is a homogeneous function of degree 7/3 with respect to the periods of the associative free form. And because of the homogeneity of the seven-dimensional volume, it satisfies, so the volume satisfies this property and the Kähler potential satisfies these two properties. And right now, these are the only this is the only property that we're going to rely on in our construction. And we know that this is a generic property for all G2 manifolds. Yeah, so we're going to work, as I said, we're working in the framework of N equals 1, D equals 4 supergravity. But they have corrections in terms of There will be corrections, but they will be suppressed in this limit. So this is the same way as people would. Sorry?
Are you taking all module at large? Those are module at large.
Mm-hmm. Right, right.
So you're in a limit where they have a large value.
Yeah.
All of them.
Yeah. So the singularities arise from collapsing two cycles, but these don't represent two cycles. These are periods of the free form. So the two cycles give you gauge degrees of freedom, such as charged matter fields and non-abelian gauge fields. So when you two cycles also give you U1s, but they don't give you moduli. Codimension 4 is a supersymmetric free cycle. The singularity is along the free cycle. So, but it's not a collapsing free cycle. Okay, so in the previous work, we actually assumed a particular form of the volume, which was a product of these periods, which sum up to 7/3. And we also assumed this form for the Kähler potential for charged chiral matter. But in this work, we actually generalized the model completely, and we didn't have to make these assumptions at all. So this is what I'm going to present here. But of course, all the conclusions that were that we came to for these specific models, they don't change. So qualitatively, it stays the same. Okay, so if you would like to compute, for instance, the soft Susie breaking terms, you also need to know the Kähler potential for matter fields. So what do we know about matter fields? We know that they're localized at point-like codimension 7 singularities in the internal manifold, and we expect that the bulk physics should not affect the physics at the singularity. So a single conical singularity gives you n of SUn, and that gives you a trivial, if you want to write down the superpotential, it's going to be you can't, because there is no gauge invariant combination that you can write down from a single n. So therefore, there is no D flat direction that corresponds. There is just no local modulus, essentially, because there is no gauge invariant operator that you can write down. So if you cannot construct any holomorphic gauge invariant operators out of a single n, then there shouldn't be any local moduli. So the local, so the two cycle which collapses, as I said, which produces this chiral matter fields, it's not a modulus in some sense. So now the physical, the natural frame in M theory is the 11 dimensional frame, and there is a two cycle which collapsed, and that two cycle is not a geometric modulus. That two cycle gives you this, it controls, so there is a U1 that associated with this two cycle. When it collapses, you have extra degrees of freedom coming from membranes which can wrap this two cycle. So they give you matter degrees of freedom, but they're not geometric moduli. Does that make sense? Okay, so if you're interested in computing the Kähler potential for matter fields, you can start out in the 11-dimensional frame and write down the following adsatz for the kinetic term. So phi here would be the scalar component of the charged chiral matter field, superfield, where kappa would be some scale invariant function, homogeneous function of degree zero, which may depend on the bulk moduli. So the analog of this function in type 2a, for example, would be some ratio of gamma functions that depend on the angles, intersecting angles, and those are scale invariant as well. So here we would expect that there would be a similar story. So when we integrate over the seven-dimensional manifold and go to the four-dimensional Einstein frame, we get an extra rescaling. So we can just read off the Kähler potential from the kinetic term, and this is what we get. So the same result can be obtained alternatively by looking at the relation between the Yukawa couplings in the superpotential, Y prime, and the physical Yukawa couplings. So N equals 1, D equals source supergravity, they are related by this rescaling, where K tilde is the eigenvalue of the Kähler metric for the charge matter field. So we know that there are local models in M theory, which are just Alef vibrations over some three cycle, some supersymmetric three cycle, which could be a sphere or length space. And this would correspond to type 2A constructions with intersecting D-sig brains, where you have an effective seven-dimensional gauge theory on D-sig brains. And if we require that the physical coupling stays finite when the seven-dimensional volume goes to infinity, which also corresponds to M Planck goes to infinity, then the scaling of the Kähler metric for the charged matter fields should go like 1 over volume also, such that the physical Yukawa stays finite in this limit. So, and of course, there's going to be some scale invariant function, which I call kappa. So the visible sector, Kähler potential, presumably, should have this form, where this would be some scale invariant, some matrix, flavor matrix, whose components are scale invariant. And so Q here is the visible sector field, matter field, such as a quark or a lepton. And this term here represents a possible cross-coupling between the hidden sector field phi and the visible sector field Q. If this field gets a large F term, then you could potentially induce dangerous flavor-changing neutral currents. And it turns out to prevent, in order to prevent such such flavor violation, we need to make one assumption, which is that the flavor structure of this higher order term is the same as the flavor structure of the leading term, such that we can pull out this function like this, and this function is flavor independent. So there is now no top-down motivation for this, but this is motivated from bottom up. So you can also suppress if you could suppress these couplings by taking C to zero, then that's another way out. Yeah. At some conical singularity, at a different point in the manifold. Okay, so now. Let's expand the associative three form in a particular basis. And let's choose this basis in such a way that, so the basis of these harmonic three forms is such that the periods of the co-associative four form, the dual, which is the dual of phi, the periods over the cycles that are Poincaré dual, this beta I is the Poincaré dual of this form, such that the periods are positive. Okay, so we choose a basis of harmonic three forms, such that this holds. In this way, we know that the volumes of these four cycles are greater than or equal than this period. The equality holds when this four cycle is supersymmetric. In general, this four cycle is not supersymmetric, so the volume will be greater than this period. And by requiring positivity, we will just ensure that all the volumes are positive. So it's just the choice of the basis. This corresponds, for instance, in type 2b to choosing a particular condition for the Kähler cone, that all the two cycles Ti inside the Kähler cone are positive. So just choosing a basis of two cycles in type 2b, so here we choose a similar cycle. Now, here is a crucial point. So we will consider an associative free cycle Q, which can be expanded again in terms of harmonic free forms. And so here, these are the periods of the free form phi. And n, I are the integers which specify the homology of this cycle. And we will consider all G2 compactifications, all G2 manifolds, where there is an associative free cycle, a supersymmetric free cycle Q, which supports a Gugino condensate, such that in the above basis of the harmonic free forms, which I specified on the previous slide, the integers n, I are also positive. So this is a very special choice of a three cycle. Just like in type 2b, this would correspond to choosing a divisor which is ample. So I don't know of a mathematical description of such three cycles, and maybe mathematicians present in the audience could tell me something about it, but I don't know. Another way of saying it is that we require that this free cycle, associative free cycle, is Poincaré dual to the co-associative 4 form. Just like the ample divisor is Poincaré dual to the 1,1 form inside the Keller cone in type 2b. Okay. So, as I said, all the moduli in this compactifications enjoy the PQ symmetry, the PQ shift symmetry, and therefore we expect that the entire superpotential is non-perturbative. So, because it's non-perturbative, you don't expect that all the exponential terms in the superpotential will be of the same order of magnitude. So, let's write down the superpotential in this form, where this term and this term are the leading, the dominant exponential terms, and the rest of them are exponentially suppressed relative to these two terms. And let us assume that these two terms come from Gugino condensates, as opposed to instantons. Furthermore, at least one of the hidden sectors, so both of these come from some hidden sectors, and at least one of them contains vector-like matter fields. So this guy would come from some pure glue super Yngmills, and this could come from some super QCD, where SUNC would be the gauge group here, and SUM is the gauge group here. Of course, you can ask me, what if I consider matter field here? It turns out that it doesn't give you anything new, because when you compute the F term for these matter fields, because the relative phase of these two terms is minus 1, when you compute one of the F terms, it will be non-cancelable, whereas the other F term will be cancelable. And therefore, one of these fields will dynamically adjust itself in such a way that the corresponding F term will be 0. So it's irrelevant. And it's enough to consider matter field in one of these sectors. We actually, in the very, very, very first paper with Diana Vaman, we only considered pure glue condensates.
So why this one?
Because we would like to get De Sitter vacua. If you don't have, if you just have pure glue, then you get ADS, supersymmetric ADS vacua. And if you want to generate De Sitter vacua, you use F terms that come from matter fields. No, it comes from point-like singularities. Yeah, so in type 2A, these are intersection.
Yeah,
but
that means, you know, the charge on the two gauge group factors typically
this size,
because they appear at
the intersection. There is only one, well, okay. So you can obtain this in one way, which is you take SO 2n plus m, and you can break it by a Wilson line to SUN cross SUM cross U1, cross U1, two U1s.
If you're doing unfolding, can you just
I'm using discrete Wilson line. So I'm not doing any unfolding, I'm just using discrete Wilson line. So I break SO2 n plus m to SO to SUN cross SUM cross U1 cross U1, and my 2m plus n representation goes into n plus n bar plus m bar, and n bar combine into this meson field, and m bar can combine into a meson field charge under this guy. So I have vector-like, two vector-like multiplets. One transforming under this guy, and the other transforming under this guy. SO. SO go to SU. Yeah.
You have to justify this from geometrical outcome.
Sure, sure, sure. If my free cycle, so the free cycle which supports these gauge groups could be a length space. I can turn on discrete Wilson line on length space. And I can break it. It's just a general, I mean, it's very general. I don't want to pigeonhole myself to some very specific model. I just want to give a general recipe of getting the sitter. I mean, this is pretty standard way of getting the sitter vacuum in type 2B as well. You don't need anti-brains either. You can just generate it by F-term uplifting. So I'm just using sort of the standard result. Nothing new here. Okay, so this is an effective meson field. This guy transforms as N, and this guy transforms as N bar under SUN. Okay, so by the way, so this gauge kinetic function here is the same in both sectors. As I said, this could come from, this product gauge group could come from some higher gauge group by breaking it by a discrete Wilson line. Why not?
You're making strong assumptions. Fine, you're telling me I'm doing effective supergravity with that type of, you know, dime of the Dyberg superpotential and analyze it. But if you're claiming this coming from T2, then you have to be more concrete how this really arises geometrically.
It's very easy to arrange it geometrically. Very easy. I have a codimension 7 singularity which supports charge matter field. I break the gauge group by a discrete Wilson line, and it gives me vector-like spectrum in both under both of these gauge groups. The Wilson line is supported along the free cycle, whose volume is the imaginary part of the gauge kinetic function. There is no Wilson line modulus. It's a discrete Wilson line. Yes. Justify what? Yeah, so you have a single free cycle, right, which supports an SO2M plus N gauge group. And you turn on discrete Wilson line to break this gauge group into a product. So the gauge kinetic function in both subfactors will be the same. Just like the standard model, break SU5 to the product of SU3 cross SU2 cross U1. At the gut scale, all the couplings are the same. It's the same thing, just the hidden sector. So you can compute the inverse scalar metric. Here, we made one simplification, which we will remove at the end. So the simplification is that this function, the scalar invariant function, is assumed to be a constant. So in this case, so these are the components of the inverse scalar metric. Now, these parameters AI are new variables which parameterize the moduli space. So these are scalar invariant variables, and they satisfy this constraint. So there are only n minus one of these that are independent. So in order to parameterize the moduli space, you use n minus one of these guys plus the seven-dimensional volume, or you can also use the volume of the associative free cycle. So it's just a different parameterization of the moduli space, but it turns out that the introduction of these variables is very crucial for our ability to actually compute the moduli VEFs by minimizing the supergravity scalar potential. And so these contraction properties are also very general. I haven't used anything specific about the G2 manifold. All I used is the homogeneity of the volume with respect to the periods. So this is the general form of the n equals 1, d equals 4 supergravity scalar potential, which we need to minimize. And so we can solve it in the limit when this volume, the volume of the hidden sector 3 cycle, which supports the hidden sector gauge groups, is large. And if you're familiar with brace track models, you can recognize this formula immediately. Now you can ask me, so what did you do? You just did a race track. And where is M theory here? Well, M theory is here and here. Okay, so the moduli VEFs, the VEFs of the individual moduli, are proportional to the volume of this three cycle with some coefficients. And these coefficients depend on the microscopic physics. So these angular variables can be found by solving a system of n transcendental equations. So k here is the scalar potential, which contains the volume. So if you know the volume in terms of the periods, you can compute this, and then you can get the VEFs of the moduli. So that's where M theory input is coming in. The seven-dimensional volume, so this is just a general formula. So we reduced the problem of finding solutions to the supergravity equations of motion to a problem of finding these angular variables at the minimum. So this is the seven-dimensional volume, and you see that it's also proportional to the volume of the cycle, Q. You can also alternatively express the moduli VEFs in a different way if you introduce dual variables, tau. So in type 2b, for instance, you can work either with two cycles or four cycles. So the four cycles are derivatives of the Calabi-Yau volume with respect to the two cycles. So here, we can take derivatives of the seven-dimensional volume with respect to the periods of the associative free form, and we call those things tau. And these are periods of the co-associative four form. Now, when we minimize the scalar potential, this is what we get in terms of taus. So there is an analog of that in type 2b in our paper with Stewart and Folker and Piusz, where the taus would be the little t's, the volumes of two cycles, and those would be proportional to the integers specifying the homology of the ample divisor. Here we have a completely the same story, except that the taus are the periods of the co-associative four form. And so what this relation is telling you is that the homology of this three cycle dynamically fixes the co-associative four form, and this constant of proportionality is fixed by the supergravity scalar potential. So this is the relation between the three cycle, the associative three cycle, which is Poincaré dual, to the co-associative four form. You can then recast the seven, if you can. I don't know if you can always do that, but suppose you could do that. Suppose you could recast the seven-dimensional volume in terms of the periods of the co-associative four form. Just like in type 2b, you can write down the volume in terms of either two cycles or four cycles. There is a non-trivial map between those two. But suppose you could do that, then the volumes of all, the periods as I could be expressed in this more compact form, in not in terms of those angular variables, but directly as derivatives of the log of the volume. So in type 2b, we can be more explicit because in type 2b, we actually know what the volume is. It's a cubic polynomial in terms of the two cycle volumes. So here, dljk are the triple intersection numbers, and ni's are just the integers specifying the volume of the ample divisor. So these two forms are very, very analogous to each other. The difference here is the factor of 3, which comes from the fact that this is a cubic guy, and the factor of 7/4 comes from the fact that this is a homogeneous function of degree 7/4. Now, in type 2b, we can be more concrete. So we have this example in this paper where all the taus, so it was a three-parameter example, and all the basis 4 cycles and the basis 2 cycles and the six-dimensional volume could be computed at the minimum as a function of one parameter, tau d, which was the volume of the ample divisor. So you can see that at the minimum, the Kähler moduli in type 2b are controlled by single parameter tau d, whereas in G2 compactifications, this is true for all the moduli, not just for some subclass of moduli, but for all the moduli. So it means that this approach is very, very highly constraining. There is one parameter that controls all the moduli physics, essentially. So the fact that I could write the Kähler potential in this form and I didn't have to take into account higher order corrections. Yeah, so as long as this volume is large, then all the volumes are large because they're all proportional to it. Oh, this is fixed by your superpotential. In the type in this framework, it's fixed by the racetrack. So, right. So this would be in type 2b. This would be your tau. These ranks of gauge groups. You have to have gauge groups whose ranks are large enough, such that this guy is large, or this ratio has to be large enough. So these are parameters that enter the superpotential. They have nothing to do with the Kähler potential.
But my understanding is in type 2b, you're doing an analog of the old heterality. There is a flux term plus the genome, right?
Yeah, you can do that as well. Yeah, you can do either or. In type 2b, you can do racetrack in type 2b. You will have the same formula.
Well, but there you have to stabilize one set of moduli.
Yeah, yeah. So if you can tune the flux contribution to be small, then you could do that. But the point is that it is the superpotential that gives you a parametrically large value for this guy. And it controls the values of the rest of the moduli in this framework. Okay. So the point is that it turns out if you want to compute Suzy breaking parameters, you don't have to know the explicit values of these guys. And you don't have to know the explicit values of these angular variables at the minimum. All you have to know are these contraction properties. So I guess I'm running out of time. So very quickly, I just wanted to point out the following relation. So what about this meson field? So its VEV, at the minimum, can also be computed in terms of the microscopic parameters that enter the superpotential. So this is the VEV of the meson field. And if you tune the vacuum energy, if you require that the vacuum energy is zero at the minimum, you see that this is a quadratic equation with respect to this guy. So you can set the discriminant to zero, and you get this constraint. So this is a constraint on the parameters of the superpotential. And it turns out that in order to get De Sitter vacua in this framework, you need to have m greater than p. This is because the first sector contains matter, and the second sector doesn't contain matter. So if M is greater than P, then P effective has to be greater than zero, which also imposes a requirement on this combination to be greater than zero, which means that from here, you can see that M minus P has to be greater than or equal to 3. So it's a discrete choice. So if M minus P is, say, 2 or 1, then your vacuum is destabilized. You just don't get a De Sitter vacuum. If you are interested in ADS vacuum, then there is no such constraint. But if you're interested in De Sitter vacuum, then you get this constraint. So the smallest value that you have is M minus P equals 3. So if you substitute M minus P equals 3 here, here, and here, you get a constant for P effective. And you also get a constant for this guy.
Okay.
Yeah?
Coming back to the question I asked you, so what sets the scale of the customer data function?
What sets the scale?
Yes.
I will get to this in a second. Okay? So for M minus P equals 3, this is what we get for this thing P effective. This is what we get for the moduli valves in this effective meson field. Now the question is, can we actually tune this thing? What is it that we're tuning here? So remember that in this gauge kinetic functions of the hidden sector could also receive threshold corrections from Kaluza-Klein scale, from Kaluza-Klein states, which live on the 3-cycle. So when you turn on your discrete Wilson line to break the gauge group, you're going to receive, get threshold corrections. And it turns out that if the 3-cycle, for instance, is a length space, like this, you can compute them in terms of these racing or torsion clauses. And so you can express P effective in terms of them. And so here, Q is the order of the fundamental group of the 3-cycle. And W and L are the discrete Wilson line winding numbers. So you can actually tune the effective roughly to the value that you want for these discrete choices. And back to your question, what is actually tuning the cosmological constant here? So remember that you also have these Coleman-Weinberg type superpotential contributions to the scalar potential. So at the level of this tuning, the value of the cosmological constant is still large. It's roughly something like 10 to the negative 3 times m3 half squared times m Planck squared. So you still have to tune by many orders of magnitude. Now, if you include these perturbative corrections, you see that they come from various multiplets. So these multiplets contain scalars, Gauginos, and these contributions exist once you break supersymmetry. So for instance, you can have contributions from SUN Gauginos. So this ni squared here appears because an SUN contains n squared minus 1 gauge degrees of freedom. So you have lots of gauge degrees of freedom which could potentially contribute to the vacuum energy. And W's here are the winding numbers of the discrete Wilson line. And these contributions come roughly at the same order of magnitude as the leading contribution, which I was tuning by choosing those P effective. So I don't know at present if the scan of these over these discrete integers is fine enough to actually tune the vacuum energy. I don't know this at this moment. But this could be a possibility to actually further tune the vacuum energy. Yeah. You will have two loop and et cetera, et cetera. So you have to take them all into account, of course. So, but I'm just saying that there are gazillions of contributions which are comparable to the leading contribution. Okay, so just quickly wanted to point out at the following fact, the 3-cycle volume, once you fix this P effective, by coarsely tuning the cosmological constant, gives you this, and then you can plug it back to the superpotential, and you see that the leading contribution in the superpotential is completely fixed. It's just a pure number, essentially, up to some constant, up to a normalization constant. Now, you can say, okay, if I have another contribution to the superpotential, like this, where this is a volume of some other 3-cycle, I can plug these moduli valves here, and I can compute its volume. So these integers, they specify the homology of this other cycle, and generically I expect that these are of the same order of magnitude as these. So I get something that's proportional to m, just like this volume is proportional to m, because the volumes of all the moduli are proportional to the same thing. So then this contribution to the superpotential, you can see that could be parametrically suppressed relative to the leading contributions, when, especially when m prime is smaller than m. So suppose this m is of order 10 and m prime is just 1, if the actual contributions come from instantons. Then this double condensate regime is very safe. Now, if you compute the gravitino mass, this is what you get in general. And then if you plug in m minus p equals 3, then you get this. So up to the 7-dimensional volume, you basically determine the gravitino mass. And you can determine the 7-dimensional volume almost from the relation between the 4-dimensional Planck scale and the GOT scale, alpha GOT, and the volume of the visible sector cycle, which is roughly alpha GOT inverse. So you substitute these values here, and you can extract the 7-dimensional volume up to this quantity. So this is from this paper by Friedman and Witten. And again, this quantity comes from these Reisinger torsion classes, and W and Q are integers, and you can choose them. So Q controls the order of the fundamental group in the visible sector 3 cycle, and W is just a winding number. So you get these numbers for the 7-dimensional volume, and you get this number for the gravitino mass. So by tuning the cosmological constant in the leading order, you have essentially constrained the gravitino mass. So you don't have to tune the gravitino mass and the cosmological constant separately. So one thing, tuning one thing automatically gives you another thing. Okay, so basically, Piyush mentioned this, and Gordy also talked about it. So the case where this kappa is not constant gives you this formula for the moduli webs. So here you have two types of angular variables, AI and CI. So you can solve a system of, now it's going to be 2n transcendental equations, where kappa is a sum function, some scale invariant function. And if you knew, you know, if you knew the volume and this function, you could find C's and A's. So this is just a general formula which you can apply if you had a G2 compactification. But the point is that also the VEV of the canonically normalized meson field is actually the same. Even in this case, it stays the same. Okay, I'm almost done. I just wanted to point out the reason why we can compute the soft terms. So when we use those contraction properties that I also pointed out before, we can compute the F terms. So you can see that the F term with respect to the moduli is suppressed by this P effective, which is roughly 60. And all of these moduli F terms are proportional to the moduli VEVs times some constant. And there is this hierarchy. So when you compute something like the scalar mass, you can use the homogeneity. When you do the contraction with the F term, you contract with this SI. And because this is a homogeneous function, you just get back the same function. So you don't need to know what this is, and you don't need to know what this is exactly. You don't need to know any details. This, all you have to know is the how it scales. So this is a summary of the soft Susie breaking terms. You have the tree-level contribution to the gauge genome mass, and it is suppressed. So we need to include the anomaly mediation contribution. So the anomaly mediated contribution has two pieces. This is the so-called conformal anomaly, and this is the so-called Kanishi anomaly. And you see that, so this quantity K is determined here. Of course, it's also determined when you set M minus P equals 3. This is going to be a pure number. So this is a pure number, and this is also a pure number. But you see that there is an interesting relation. between, for instance, the Konnichi anomaly and the tree level contribution to the trilinear, and the one loop anomaly contribution and the conformal anomaly contribution to the gauge NMS are also related. Well, this is more obvious. So there is some non-trivial structure to these soft terms. Also, this factor of 7/3, so this is a scalar mass squared, the presence of this factor can be traced back to the fact that the volume is a homogeneous function of degree 7/3. Okay, so I think I'll probably stop here. Thank you.
All right, we've got maybe one or two questions. What's the mass of your scalar Lewis signal? The lightest modulus?
The lightest modulus is about twice the gravitational mass. It's slightly smaller, but about a factor of two, but slightly smaller.
We have all these,
Oh, C is the parameter that controls the high order contribution to the Kale potential for the visible sector fields. It controls the coupling between the meson field and the visible sector fields. So if this coupling is very small, then the scalars become very heavy. But if this coupling approaches one, you approach what is called the sequestered limit. And then the scalars become heavy, the Konnichi anomaly becomes small, and you arrive at something that is called mirage mediation. So this model is a generalization of mirage mediation. So mirage mediation models are contained in this class. Oh, they are at tree level. Here, this is the tree level contribution.
I'm sorry, I confused you. Okay, given the time, we should probably have any further questions in the conversation. So let's thank the speaker again. Thank you.